This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. I would like to begin with my own question. Your skills as a historian are impeccable, and you have many accolades that certainly support this. However, I did not notice in your book any emotion. You told your story, you told Rosemary's story with very little, if any, passion, as a historian should. But as I read it, I became more and more angered. And my question is really in two parts. First, did you feel that anger? And secondly, if you did, how did you handle it on a personal level?
I was very angry doing this research. It was so painful reading these letters, looking at that research, understanding what Rosemary endured and what her parents did to her. They were wrong. And I would go back and forth between trying to understand them and then really being angry with them. They struggled with having a child with disabilities when there were very few resources available to them at the time. Even in the public school systems, the teachers didn't know what to do with Rosemary. Today, a child like Rosemary would be completely mainstreamed. She would end up living a probably fairly independent life with support. But they didn't have those resources. However, they did have a lot of money, and I think that they spent the money in ways that were not productive for Rosemary, and frankly, they just wanted her out of the way, and that was extremely frustrating. So on the one hand, I appreciated their struggles with a child with disabilities. On the other hand, given their resources, I condemn them for their treatment of their daughter. And by the way, an editor took out a lot of the emotion that I had in some of my... So that's what editors are for.
Feet of clay. What has been the reaction of the Kennedy family to your book?
There has been no public comment about my book. I have heard through people who know the Kennedys that some of them are pleased with the book. That's all I can say. I did interview some of the Shriver children. They did tell me, Timothy and Anthony in particular, and Anthony was incredibly close to his aunt Rosemary. Eunice was always very close to Rosemary as a child and then as an adult monitoring Rosemary's care. And so he grew up being very close to Rosemary. And he told me that he did not know what happened to his aunt. He only knew her as a disabled adult whom he loved. And frankly, that none of the Kennedy generation knew or understood what happened to her. And he actually said to me when I first started the research, I hope you can find out what happened to her. And Timothy Shriver wrote a book that came out, I think, in 2012. And he writes in his book about Rosemary and how he asked his Uncle Ted and his mother Eunice one night at dinner, what happened to Rosemary? And Eunice said to him, she didn't know where Rosemary was for 10 years. And Teddy had no idea. He just missed his older sister. So the kids were not clued in, and so the younger generations were not given any information either.
Did Rose ever write about any regrets she may have had about Rosemary's care or about what happened to Rosemary? Were there any writings on Rose's part?
Rose wrote about all the efforts that they went to try to cure Rosemary. And when she was an older woman and Eunice and all these other people were doing more research into the causes of intellectual disabilities, et cetera, Rose began to understand what had happened to Rosemary, but she never expressed regret at what they had done. And in fact, she made a chilling comment in her memoir about she couldn't understand how God could take three able-bodied, wonderful sons, Joe, who's killed in a plane crash, Jack assassinated, Bobby assassinated, and leave her with her disabled daughter. Very chilling.
So what is your impetus for bringing this very personal part of a family story to the public? What drives you to do this?
Well, as a historian who wants to bring to the public the story of women's lives and how they actually impact us every day. We all grew up learning history mostly through the lens of great white men. But when you look at history through the lens of women, that history looks a little different. And so when you look at the Kennedy family through Rosemary, you see that family very differently, very differently. And I think it's really important to not only include women in our history, but sometimes the voiceless have such an incredible impact and we need to give them a voice. And with the Kennedys, those siblings were deeply affected by their sister. If Rosemary did not have her difficulties, if those things had not happened to her, I question whether they would have been such champions of people with disabilities.
There are several questions that are quite similar, and they center on the lobotomies, the further history of lobotomies, as well as the doctors that performed them. What is the history from Rosemary onward, as well as were these doctors ever prosecuted for these experiments?
They were never prosecuted for these experiments, and as I said, there were no patient protections back in the day, no protocols for research and using human subjects like today. There are a lot of protocols and requirements that companies and people have to go through, and consent, informed consent. James Watts was actually a neurosurgeon. He stopped doing them within a few years after Rosemary was operated on. Walter Freeman, who actually was not officially a doctor, he was a psychologist, he went on to develop the ice pick method that was so famous. The operation that Rosemary had was where they drilled holes on both temples and went in the sides of her skull. But later, Walter Freeman, developed the ice pick method where he just put the ice pick in the eye socket and cracked a little entry point so that he could put in a little spatula to scrape the frontal lobes. The surgery became popular during the 40s and into the 1950s, but people were complaining about it and trying to stop it because they recognized that it was not a good thing. It only helped a very few people. The introduction of psychopharmaceuticals, drugs that could help with lots of mental illness, started appearing in the 1950s, so a lot of people no longer were candidates for lobotomy. And by the 1960s, it was becoming incredibly unpopular, and then they stopped doing it in the 1970s. Today, it is very, very rarely done. The scary thing is, during the 1940s and 1950s, 60 to 80% of the lobotomies were performed on women, depending on the hospital, but they were 40% or less of admissions to psychiatric hospitals. So the predominant patient were women, and they had no rights, they had no control over saying no to the surgery. Their families could force them to do it. So fortunately, that's changed.
We have several questions also about Rosemary's life in Wisconsin. People are interested whether or not she had daily activities she was able to participate in. Where was she the most happy? I think we'd like to have some ray of hope that there were times in Rosemary's life when there was a real joy.
I feel that she had a very full, happy life at St. Coletta's. The nuns there were amazing. She got really great medical care there. Interestingly, she was moved there in 1949 after she had been at the Craig House, which was not an appropriate setting for her. So a few years after she had been at St. Coletta's, there was a new doctor that was assigned to Rosemary's care, and he decided to lighten up on some of the medication that she was taking that she had come from the Craig House taking. So he took her off this medication, and all of a sudden she started to talk. So she was being over-medicated. The Kennedys paid for an Olympic-sized swimming pool to be built there, and she swam every day. They built a little house for her to live on the campus of the school, and a nun lived with her. She had friends she loved that she would spend her days with. She loved to hear people play the piano and to sing. So she had a really good life. And when she visited at home, it was very difficult for her. She resented her mother tremendously. She blamed her mother apparently for what happened to her. The first time Rose saw her, Rose did not see Rosemary for 20 years after the operation. 1962, she traveled to Wisconsin to see Rosemary for the first time, and Rosemary screamed at her and hit her. So there was a lot of resentment and anger. Other than that, she had a very nice life at St. Colette's.
That's really heartening to hear. Yeah. Thank you. There are some questions about Joe Kennedy and vanity as far as his role in this. Was it through vanity? Did he have these desires to make her normal, to have anything that was necessary to normalize her due to his own personal vanities?
I have no doubt that Joe wanted Rosemary out of the way because of his own political aspirations and his aspirations for his sons, Joe Jr. and Jack. Absolutely. Otherwise, he could have sent her to live in an apartment in San Francisco or someplace else, but he just wanted her out of the way, and it jaded every decision he made about Rosemary. Absolutely.
We also have questions about the home delivery, the delayed delivery. Did Joe and Rose ever attribute Rosemary's issues to that medical delay and forcing Rose to not deliver at the appropriate time?
No, they did not attribute it to that moment until much, much later. Actually, Joe probably never did. But Rose became actively involved in raising money to support research into the causes of intellectual disabilities during the 1960s and 1970s. Back in 1918, when this happened, it was not known that depriving a child of oxygen in the birth canal would cause intellectual disability, so the nurse didn't know that. And it was only in the 1970s that Rose figured out that's probably what happened. They used to tell people before, when Rosemary was a child, that she had scarlet fever, and that is what caused her disabilities. But she had scarlet fever when she was 5, and she was already exhibiting tremendous delays and disabilities much before that.
We also have a question about the reaction to emotional and intellectual disabilities that was common at the time. Can you contrast that with the current profile that we see as far as how we view emotional and intellectual disabilities?
I think there's a difference between the treatment of people with emotional disabilities and mental illness and intellectual disabilities and physical disabilities. Back in the 19-teens and 1920s, people with physical and intellectual disabilities were shunned. They were called imbeciles and morons, and the eugenics movement was very popular at the time, and people were discouraged from having children who had disabilities, that they might pass on a bad seed. It was terrible, terrible, terrible attitudes. That changed starting in the 1950s and 1960s and into the 70s. Certainly the Kennedys played a huge role in changing the way we look at people with disabilities. And now we have inclusion in classrooms, and so much more research has been put into how to teach children with intellectual disabilities and helping children with physical disabilities and adults live independently and be part of society today. When it comes to mental illness, as you know, this is still an issue in our country. We need to do something about it. My resentment towards the Kennedys also related to the fact that when they finally admitted to the country in 1962 that Rosemary was born with intellectual disabilities, they did not admit that she suffered from mental illness. And if they had been champions of research and more treatment for people with mental illness as well, I think today we would be much farther along in providing resources and help for people with mental illness. But they did not, and they are still resisting doing that. And every time I give a lecture, I call out to them to become part of making sure that we contribute the same sort of attention and resources to helping to solve the issues and problems of mental illness.
Tangential to your research on Rosemary, I'm sure, as you have just mentioned about the Nazi eugenics movement, which actually, as we know, started here in America, what have you learned about those Nazi experiments, about the Tuskegee experiments on syphilis, some of those tangential pieces of research that may have been edited out of your book, but still would be of interest simply because of the commonalities that you did include?
Yeah, we did not put that in the book. Part of it was because, once again, there was a lack of concern for research subjects, that people who were part of the experiments were not told the truth, that doesn't happen today. There just were no patient protections, and it was during the 1960s and 70s that victims, their families, and the legal establishment stepped forward and started creating guidelines for research experiments. The eugenics movement started here in the 1800s and became more sophisticated during the early 1900s. It died out here fairly early. In the 1920s, it really had died out, but it rose to prominence under Hitler in Nazi Germany, and many, many people with disabilities were killed during the 1930s under the Nazis. It was terrible. Yeah.
We had a chance to speak earlier before your presentation, and my question is similar to the ones that have come from the audience. I was asking about your current research on a new book, and you were kind enough to share some of your thoughts on what you're going to be doing next. And we have a couple of questions wanting to know, first of all, what you're looking toward next, because we're excited to read more from you. And we also want to know how much detail you can give us on your next topic.
I can't give you much detail because I'm still trying to work through it. And it's another woman, someone that probably none of you know about, and she was quite a character, but it just hasn't hit me hard enough to sit down and devote the next couple of years to her life. But I was saying to Elaine that my agent and I just sat down to talk about doing a children's book on Harriet Tubman, because now she's going to be on the $20 bill, and I've already written this biography of her. We have two national parks in her honor, and so I really feel that I would like to do a series of children's books on Tubman. So that'll probably be my first project.
Thank you. We have time for one more question, and it has to do with home delivery and nursing, midwifery. What have you been able to determine about the history of home birth and the statistics, if there are any, of home birth versus hospital birth? How has that impacted the number of children with disabilities? Was it more common due to the home birth? What's the story behind that?
I don't know those statistics, but I can tell you I'm not sure at the time when Rose was giving birth whether there was that much difference between a home birth and a hospital birth. And when I've given lectures like this, I have had women who have come up to me and said, that happened to me in the 1940s, that happened to me in the 1950s, that happened to me in the 1960s. You know, I was in the hospital and the nurses held the baby back until the doctor could arrive. You know, the medical establishment just so took over childbirth from midwives during that time period that they had complete sway and control. In Rose's day, the doctor could not be paid his $125 fee if he was not there for the delivery. So the nurse was really compelled to wait till he showed up. And today, of course, I think there's tremendous training for midwives, and I don't know what those statistics are, but they're not holding babies back in the birth canal anymore.
Thank you so much, Dr. Larson.
Thank you.
It has been wonderful that she has shared her time and expertise with us this morning. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Virginia Eskin. She will present a musical program entitled Artistic Women of New Hampshire. She will be accompanied by mezzo-soprano Aileen E. Ruby. Thank you, Dr. Kate Larson, again, for such a wonderful talk.